Hello, everyone. Welcome to our Understanding Carpet Pythons series. And this time we are talking about diamond pythons, Moraya spilota spilota. This amazing snake is as interesting as it is beautiful. We are going to break down the natural history, the captive history of the diamond python in hopes that this will be a solid foundation for you to understand what they need to thrive in captivity and how they work. This is episode 557. All right, welcome to another episode of Moraya Python Radio. And tonight, today, whatever time you're listening to this, we're going to be talking about diamond pythons. Mm-hmm. For those that want to mention, we'll be sharing pics and stuff throughout. Hopefully, we make the episode that you can listen to it without seeing the pics. But if you want to see pics of what we're talking about, we share the video on Patreon. So if you want to dive into that, go over and check it out. You also get access to the episode early. If it's something you're interested in, go check it out. I wanted to make sure put out there that we have that Discord going on. Discord chat. I kind of like it. It's kind of like old school forum. I think it's got to get a little more people,
a little more busy
in there, a little more bubble. I think it'll probably become my place to hang out.
I
don't have to deal with bullshit.
I pop in there. I haven't really contributed too much, but I am kind of wandering around, and I'm like, I should probably do something. Yeah. I feel like I've gone back in time where I'm just the lurker, and I'm like, no one cares what I think. So.
Yes. Well, last week was your podcast tour. And this week is my podcast.
Your podcast tour. Yeah, it's a
we have tonight, God. Which this is a little late coming yes. out. And it won't be late when the people listen to it.
They won't
for the
know.
Patreon.
Yeah,
people,
they won't
a little
know.
Bit late. then tomorrow we have carpets and coffee, and then the next day we have the next NPR. And the only other thing that I had in the news is RIP.
Yeah.
Raise the glass to Richard Ross. Dr. Richard Ross. For those who don't know, I don't know. I thought maybe we'd give him a little tribute at the beginning. He was on our show. Man, I'm so glad that we were able to get him.
I said that to Melissa today. I'm so glad we got that show handled, done, you know.
Yeah. Because, man, first of all, what a great guy he was, you know. I quite enjoyed talking to him. It was a little... what would you call it? Celebrity type of thing when Richard Ross is texting you on your phone and you're like,
yeah,
this is the guy that wrote the Blue Bible.
Yeah. I like the old school Herper mentality of he's like, you know, and I love the old school Herper stories, which is why we can, you know, I'll do any episode with Ron St. Pierre any day of the week, you know, and it's, it was very cool to have him on and talk, because it's like you kind of put him up on this pedestal, because it's like this is the guy first bred White Lips, like holy crap. Like, and for him to be like, oh yeah, we were just, you know, mucking around and the power went out and holy shit, and it's like, oh, like it's cool to see beyond the veil, you know.
You bred him on accident, right?
It's that kind of stuff. And then I mean, my copy of I have a black Blue Bible. My cover is black, but it's actually signed by him too. Yeah, which is
that's awesome.
Makes it even better. Like, it makes it even more. So yeah.
For people that don't know, maybe you're new into the hobby, or you know, you're not really familiar with like how everything started back in the day. And I think a lot of times there's a lot of talk about the drugs and the biker gangs and like how reptiles was the wild, wild west back then. I'm not saying it wasn't, but then you had guys like Dr. Richard Ross that were, you know, I mean, I think he wrote the Python breeding manual in 76. So I was 2. Oh, when you weren't born?
I wasn't here. Yeah, I know.
You know?
My parents had not graduated college yet. Yeah.
Yes. And
Wow, that's pretty scary.
I did 1980. Yep.
Wow. Okay. Jim was graduating college
in Penn State of 80. Yep. Yep.
Oh,
yep.
Wow. But yeah, you know, that book, I remember when I first started wanting to get into breeding pythons, it was kind of like you had to have that book. That was the go-to book. Such a, so far ahead of its time, I think, that it came out. That
it was one of those things where I think I'd seen your copy a couple times, and I had been like, I know how to breed pythons. Like, I've done it. Like, I got it. I don't need this book. And then, like, I think it was maybe 2 years ago, something like that. I went on this, I think it was the pandemic. I think it was 2020. Mm-hmm. And I think I went on this book kick where it was like, I need to do something and add the things to the library that I should have added years ago. And that's when I started getting all the things. And
oh yeah, I remember, like, that.
Yeah. I'm like, I need to get the Blue Bible. Like, I need to start doing that. And that was one of the ones. And obviously you follow, there's a couple different Facebook groups for like herpetology books and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And one popped up and I'm like, I want it. I need it. Here you go. And bought it and got it. They're actually becoming a little bit rarer now because people have kind of realized that it's out of print and it has a lot of really good information in it. So I'm looking at one right now used online for $114.
So I would imagine it's probably going to go up.
Probably. No. So if it's something that you were like, I should probably get a copy later, like it's going to eventually get to a point where it's not there anymore and it's gone, or you can only find it on eBay. It's going to basically be, I would not be surprised if it eventually became like Pythons of the World Volume 1, where it's like every once in a while one pops up and people jump all over it. So.
God, I remember when that book, I found out about that book. I wanted that book so bad. I had an eBay. I think I paid like $200 for that book.
Jesus.
But I had to have it, man.
I mean, you do.
I had to have it.
You know, this is what's wrong with my brain. I have Pythons of the World Volume 1 and Volume 3. And you know, it's eating in my brain. In the back of my brain, it is chewing. And it's like, you need Volume 2. Volume 2 is about ball pythons. You need Volume 2.
Well, the good thing about Volume 2 is that there is a lot of information in there that you could apply to other anything that you're keeping.
Excellent. Justification to get it.
Yeah. Done. Like imagine the barkers telling you how to keep, stock your reptile room, you know, tips and tricks and mites and
I can justify it. It's fine. Okay, good.
Just skip over the ball python morph section. You'll be fine.
Just a flip. There we go.
can I cut these pages out?
Pages.
So anyway, it's a bummer. Richard Ross. It just goes to the point of why we do herp history, man. You know, he's like, that's the second one that we were able to interview before.
Well,
they're not here anymore.
I mean, it's one of those things where I'm very glad we had the episode with Rico before he passed. And now I'm very glad we had the episode with Dr. Ross before he passed. And, you know.
Yeah, big shout out to Keith McPeak for hooking that up.
Yeah. Brian, that's three guests. Damn. Brian Barczyk,
I think we had Brian on twice, if I'm not mistaken.
I think we had him on
early on.
I think he came on once, and then I think he came back to wish us like an anniversary show thing.
Yeah.
So I think it was a quick hitter, but.
Yeah, I don't know. I know he gets a lot. He used to get all. He doesn't seem like he gets that much anymore. But I never had any problems with him.
Nah, whatever.
But
we don't have any problems with anybody.
Yeah, we're Switzerland.
I mean, we do horribly abuse our intern, but.
Well, you got to take it out.
He signed up for that. He did, yes. he knew what he was getting into.
So, all right. Well, let's talk diamond pythons. I know that you're wanting.
I don't know why you're doing this to me. Like, I don't know what I did to you that you're like, let's have a whole episode on that thing that you really, really want, but you cannot, you don't have right now. It's like, why do this?
Sealing the deal.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think they may be the most stunning of the carpet pythons. I, 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 you know,
I mean, I can only agree with
you. It's hard to beat a diamond python.
I can only agree with you because how many times have we seen, like, have you ever seen an ugly diamond? Like a pure diamond. I'm not talking diamond cross or whatever. Pure diamond, regardless of what it is. Like, I'm pretty sure people have sent us pictures of them on trash cans and we're like, gorgeous. It's beautiful. Yeah. Look at it. Yeah. And the McDonald's in the background only enhances the picture. Yes. It's like, I don't. Yeah. So
look, it's a Happy Jacks. Happy Jacks. It's not Burger King. It's Happy Jacks.
Look at it, it's Happy Jacks, not Burger King. The text is the shut up. All right.
It looks just like Burger King. Well, shut up. Yeah. But yeah. What is that?
I'll have a Whopper.
Oh man. But yeah, anyway. I don't know. Diamond pythons are I think that there's a lot of misconceptions about them. I think that people think that they're probably a little bit more difficult to keep than well, they're not. They're actually easier to keep than
I had this than a lot of things. But I had this conversation with a customer this weekend because they bought a rhino, and I'm like, they're insanely easy. But if you forget everything you learned about other things, like you cannot sit there and be like, I don't know why the rhino's not enjoying the python temperatures. It's like, well, it's not that.
So, hello.
Yeah, it's like, and also it's like, it's so much easier if you just do this. Like, if you just stay in this lane, stop trying to force it into this lane. So diamonds, I think, fall into their own care and stuff like that. And of course, people, I mean, there's probably somebody who's yelling at their thing right now, being like, I keep mine in the lowest drawer on my rack and it's fine. Congratulations. Like, it's okay.
Yeah. You know, diamond pythons were the one that started making me think about, do we have to offer, like, for instance, with that species in particular, they do a lot of like basking because of where they're from. So it's a basking animal. So therefore, do you have to, use things like UV or stuff like that? There's a couple people like Brandon Wheeler, Scott Ty Iper, Tom Crutchfield that keep their diamonds outside.
Yes.
When I saw Scott and Ty's diamonds and was able to get hands on with them, they were very, I don't know, they felt tougher. Their scales were tougher or something. I don't know. I don't know if that's something to do with, being outside in the sun, being on a bask. I don't know. But I think that they were the ones that got me started to think about it and to move away from things like radiant heat panels and more into like a basking bulb type of thing. I know early on when I first started getting into diamonds, that was what Josh Easter. And I think if you go back and listen to him when he was on NPR, he sort of said the same thing. He's like, it's kind of like keeping a closed stall, but you neglect it. I was just like,
I mean, yeah.
Wait, what?
It seems
I know like, what he means, but that's probably not the best way to say it.
I mean,
say.
It's not the best way to put it, but it's going through it where it's like, so we hammered the point home in the early 2000s and stuff like that, that you should keep them in a cage with a radiant heat panel and an constant temperature and stuff like that. And it's like, well, apparently the best way to keep a diamond is in a 20-gallon long tank with a bulb that's only on during the day, which is something that, all right. Well, if it's a bearded dragon in that tank, congratulations, it's dead. But it's like they prefer the old school method apparently. So
So I think that there was something that came out a long time ago when we started first keeping diamond pythons in the States was diamond python syndrome, DPS. Mm-hmm. And basically that has kind of been debunked. Both the first and second more complete carpet python books sort of talk about how that really just chalks up to improper keeping them too warm, therefore their metabolic process speeds up and therefore, you know, they more or less go into old age. I think there's been some debate that that's not the case, but I tend to agree with that.
I tend to agree that keeping any animal too hot beyond its range is bad. So
yeah, you're going to kill it.
Exactly. So like, if we can try to dissect why the diamond python dies if it gets too hot, or we can just accept that if you keep them too hot,
yeah,
they don't do well. Done. Like, that's it. So, I mean, that's what these animals are for, or that's where they are. They're dark for the reason that they're from a colder climate, but if they don't know how to, you can't, too much of a good thing. Like, you can't just keep like hitting it with heat. It's expecting to have to fight for it, to like use it, run away. Like, yeah, it's, and it's the same 100%. Thing about anything, but you know, we've talked about this with all other aspects of reptiles. Too much of something is bad. So with diamonds, it's heat, but also we've talked about, like, I fed my diamonds rabbits. Why? Like, why did you get to that point? Like, there's all that other stuff too. It's, you know, just because a diamond python in literature maxes out at 10 foot does not mean you should try to get every single diamond python that crosses your path to 10 feet.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll get into the size we'll get into all that stuff, natural history, hobby history, some of the lines. We'll talk about keeping them, breeding them, talk about in the natural history, you know, I'll talk about how I have them set up and how most people have diamond pythons set up. And the other good thing about diamond pythons is luckily we have Dr. Richard Schein, who has done a tremendous amount of work on the natural history of diamond pythons. And a lot of information on that particular subspecies is available. You know, you can look up his papers on Google Scholar. If you are interested in his papers, like, I can just give you a quick rundown of some of the ones that he's done. There's like thermoregulation in pythons, head and body temperature difference.
Nice.
There's thermal influence of foraging ability, body size, posture, cooling rate for an ambush predator. There's the variation in mating systems and sexual dimorphism. They talk about, there's another one called large snakes in a mosaic rural landscape, the ecology of carpet pythons in Eastern Australia, but they really focus on diamond pythons there. They talk about the feeding habits of the diamond python as an ambush predator. There's a few more, there's a lot of information that you can get about the natural history of diamond pythons.
That's really cool. I have all my, papers, read for me by Dr. Julander, and then cliff note them.
He cliff note them.
Yeah, he cliff notes them for me. Yeah, that's all I ask. Yeah.
So what do you got to give him a fee every month, or how does that work?
Yeah,
I got signed up.
Listen,
on that.
I get you got to give him. You have to. What do you think you have to pay?
Oh, sweet lady DDP.
Thank you. You have to give him a case of Dr. Pepper. Although with inflation, I don't know if I'm getting a really, you know, getting a little bit of a raw deal here.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
You know, funny thing.
Yeah.
I just started opening up out back and all because the weather's starting to break.
Yeah.
And I go and I look in my fridge that I haven't been in that downstairs all winter. I haven't gone in there all winter. It is loaded with
DDP. He went to the Sam's Club and he came back with this thing. Yeah, he's so happy.
Big, huge case. So I got you ready, John, for when you come out again.
Oh, somebody was asking about Carpet Fest. We have to talk
about that. Pick a date for that.
We have to have a meeting. I'm sorry. I digress. So yes. Diamond pythons.
Yeah. So let's talk about what does Morelia spilota mean? It translates to spotted Morelia. And there's a reason for that. We'll get into that.
Well, thank
later.
God they did that.
Yeah.
That was really good.
The diamond python has some differences when comparing them to other carpet pythons, which in the more complete carpet python book, Justin and Nick sort of talk about that they believe because of those things that it warrants that subspecific status. Maybe even full species, perhaps. Some people believe that they should be a full species. But we won't get into. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that. I'm kind of going with the subspecies thing, but yeah. It's interesting what we think of a diamond and what some of the wild diamonds look like. There was one I shared in the chat yesterday asking Justin about this stripe looking diamond python that was just sort of chilling on a branch. And I was like, this looks, let me see if I can share it real quick. But what a stripe, you know? And I was like, holy shit, I can't believe how, you know, well, it almost looks like what I would.
So it looks like it shouldn't be like a pure diamond or?
No, it looks to me, when I saw it, I thought.
We're in the intergrade zones.
Jungle carpet or intergrade zone. Oh. Yeah, for sure.
I mean, that's the other problem again, is like with Morelia in general, the variability is insane, but
yeah,
I mean, again, I've never seen it. I think this year is going to be a really good year for diamonds just because I know Gary Schivino got Lux. I know, Brian Hayes got Lux. A lot of people are breeding their diamonds and so that would be a good year. Jesus. All right. That's a diamond?
Yes.
Are we sure it's a diamond?
Well, I asked Justin what his thoughts were. So it's this diamond was found in Port Stevens, right? And that's still considered solid diamond python territory.
Yeah, but look at how big the ocelli are on the side.
Well, that's kind of my point. It's like, you know, you think.
And the head looks weird. Like it doesn't look.
It looks very jungly, unless it is possible. It is possible. One of the things that Justin did say is that perhaps regarding that it's not an escaped pet, which is possible, right? You know, I'm sure that's possible.
A pet escaped and that was this one's parent. Like, you know, it was.
I suppose that's possible, too. But basically, this animal looks like a striped jungle carpet, if you
will. Yeah.
But a lot more tipping, I guess. That you see up in the and it's very dark, very dark.
Lots of tipping and lots of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That one's from Port Stevens. So. So yeah, I'll share the picture over in the Discord so people can check it out. If you don't subscribe to the Patreon, if you want to get in that, just message me or Owen, and we'll get you in there. But anyway, back on track.
Yeah.
I don't know. So they diamond pythons are different from all other carpet pythons, and as you know, their color and pattern are different. For the most part, they are basically a very dark background snake with these, what we call rosettes of white or yellow flecking, throughout, you know, going down the back. They have behavioral differences. They mate differently than, the stuff that's going up the East Coast. They don't do male combat. It's probably due to the fact that most carpets that where there's the female is sexually the sexual dimorphism where the female's bigger,
right?
The males don't combat, which we'll get into that. There's a lot of mating balls. That was another thing I never knew about diamond pythons. And their adaption to temperate climate. They're the most southern ranging
python
in the world. And, you know, I think so. Again, there was the study back to that sexually dimorphic thing. Females grow a little longer and heavier than males. Slip and shine paper was one of the ones I talked about earlier, recorded that diamond pythons averaging 12% larger than males. I think the only thing with that study was that the sample size was relatively small. I think it was 12 animals, if I'm not mistaken. You know, the Taylor thesis detected some distinctions in the mitochondrial DNA associated with diamond pythons, which they basically form a well-defined subclade. The crazy thing is that Justin and Nick had brought out in the book is that diamond pythons and brettles are actually sister species, which... It's kind of like when you're looking at that, you're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
So,
I mean, it makes sense that like the bread lie are off on their own thing, and they're closest related to diamonds as opposed to like everything else. Yeah, so
there's not a lot of variation in a lot of diamond pythons. Probably similar to Bredley, I guess. Right? Yeah. I mean, there's not a whole lot of variation with them.
No,
as opposed to like coastal carpets, which,
right?
You know, yeah. Variety is just off the, you know, this one's gold, this one's brown,
yeah.
This one's, you know,
and also it's like with Bredley and diamonds, it's like how would you attack a diamond python? Care well, same goddamn way I would do a Bredley. How would you do Bredley? Same damn way I would do a diamond. Like they fit in that care thing, in my opinion, together. So
yeah, so just so people know, like for me, right, you know, you've heard a lot of talk about how I have two rooms, and you know, this room that I do the podcast in, I consider the cold room. When eventually it's all said and done, and hopefully the diamonds breed this year, I get some eggs, and then I can start working on their cages and get them into better caging, and just redo this room. My hope is that I would have the inlands and the Bredles and the diamonds in this room.
Yeah.
So this would be like spring breeders, and then in the other room would be the winter breeders, and kind of separated that way. Therefore, I could open a window and get a 50 degrees. It's not going to phase neither. Well, actually, I don't know if you have to get the inlands that cold, but you definitely have to get diamonds that cold in order to. You've heard there are one-off clutches where people have them where they don't. That has happened, so it's not like impossible. But if you want to consistently breed it,
I love this. Now you're so well trained now over these 13 years we've had together when you're like, well, you don't have to, and I'm like, well, and you're like, well, and then you just kind of you hear me in your brain. Yes. I don't even need to talk anymore. Back. You know exactly.
Yeah, it's like a Doro check.
I want consistency. Yes.
Yeah. If you can do it once, yeah, good for you. Do it again.
Do it again.
And one more
do
time.
Do it again.
Yeah. So let's talk about their size, right? So they're regular
carpets.
They're
not 10
foot. No. Well,
no.
The largest specimen that was ever recorded was from 1972, and it was 12.1 feet. 3.7 meters. Christ.
But again, whenever I think Australia ruined me every time I think about that, all I can think about is the largest water python I've ever seen in my hands, bigger than my olive. So like it is
was a wild one.
It was a wild one. Like it's the problem is that what an animal is does not set it for all the other ones. And just because this thing was 12 feet doesn't mean it was a healthy breeding animal. Like it could, who knows how old it was and how much longer it lived after they recorded the 12 foot thing. Like it, no.
Yeah. So I want to say adults average about maybe 6 feet, 2 meters, something like that. You know,
I'd say that's about the average. Yeah. I'd say a female about 6-7 foot. Again, same size as my female Bredley. Like, that's where I would go with it.
And like Bredley, you have some very large ones, you know, that could get up to 9 foot, you know, that's definitely,
but even maybe
a big
then,
female would be like,
even then with the foot, size of a 9 foot girl, like I would never feed it guinea pigs, rabbits or anything like that. I would stick with extra large rats because they don't need that much. Like the caloric intake of some of those things is just how you get fat python. Like,
it's interesting. We'll talk a little bit about when we get into eating and feeding and stuff that, you know, they want to eat even when it's cold. So, you know,
Bredley, it's like it's 50 degrees.
Crazy.
I don't care. Give.
Yeah. As long as I wonder if they adapt to the fact that we're offering them that hot spot during the day and they feel relatively confident. I don't know if it's confidence the right word because that's like applying human thought to, you know, but they kind of like are what would trained almost to know that heat is going to come. Right. So they're maybe a little more, you know, brazen about wanting to take food down? Maybe if you took that away,
right?
Maybe they wouldn't. You know, I don't know. It's just it's
the whole thing of like it's a bright sunny day, food might be coming, and then all of a sudden we never take away that you don't go in there and go, like you know it's like and now you get darkness like it
right.
You could that be more naturalistic, but you know to say that they sometimes dude like animals are weird. So like I imagine a diamond on any kind of day where it would be bright and sunny and it would be able to warm up, this is a good day to hunt. You know, on a cold, rainy, wet day, it might be like, this might be a good day to kind of just hunker down and kind of hang on. But it's funny, like I woke up my rough scale python, one of my rough scale females, to feed her. And she got all pissed off and hyped up. She didn't eat because she was just trying to swing all over the place. And now, like, she's up in her hide, like S position, looking like it's like, well, you missed dinner. That was 3 days ago. So it's like some of them, if they're not prepared, would be like, nah. But I think a diamond and a red lie, it doesn't matter. If they were dead asleep and I smacked it on the head with the rat, it would wake up and be like, eh. Like,
yeah, 100%. There is a thought that, so like they do go through an ontogenic color change. And that I would say it's probably maybe by 2 years of age that they're sort of through that, sort of have their adult coloration. I guess they're kind of like maybe gray brown when they hatch out. I don't know what
I mean. All Morelia.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're not red. It looks like let's put it that way.
Morelia baby.
And then they have like tan colored blotches, I suppose, as when they hatch out, and then they begin to lighten up yellow or white as they get older.
That's baby jungles are gray with tan, and and then the yellow happens, so you can be like,
very similar.
It's a color change. I'm like, or the yellow comes in later. Like,
I would say that because they're from colder temperatures, that they're slower to mature. They're definitely slower to mature. I mean, as far as what you're doing in captivity, if you're talking about, I know we're sort of jumping ahead, but you know, if we're talking about breeding, I would say probably maybe males would breed at like 4 to 5 years, probably 5 years, you know, females probably 5 to 6. And I think if you're on that, that may be another reason why they're not as popular, because it's a long game. it's a long game. And I think you can't sort of cheat it, in my opinion. You can't cheat it to sort of like, you know, give it temperatures all year long, because you're really going to screw up.
I mean, you could, but how healthy is your diamond python going to be? Yeah. You're going to have two diamond pythons by the time that first clutch hits the ground. Like,
Right.
I don't know.
So here's their range. They're sort of down here.
Over there. East Coast.
They kind of, let's see. So basically their range is, they're the southernmost ranging python species. They're a little further, I think, in the complete carpet. It talks about them being a couple of degrees further south than Imbricata. And the only other species of python that would sort of be in that would be the African rock python natus. And they're several degrees further south than those as well. But Natalensis, I don't think that they can. I think they have a geographical barrier that keeps them from
going further,
any further south. You know, so
until we find the fabled Antarctic python, we're going to have to just kind of
So I'll show you. So, let's see. Basically, they all go down to Eastern Victoria, and that. Let me see if I can down to Eastern Victoria near. Oh man, I'm going to butcher this name, Malakota.
Perfect, love it. Next,
Karajingalong. And they may go as far south as the Karajingalong National Park, and as far west as, what's that other national park they were? Togoini Park. I apologize if I butchered those.
We're doing great. It's great.
But
yep. Please don't yell at us, Scott.
Yeah, right. He's throwing stuff.
Well, I mean, he does that every time he listens, but we had to give him a reason this time.
So right here, and over to here is kind of like their most southern range, right there.
That's cool.
Is what you see. So that's their southern range, and then. From that point, they go all the way up to this vicinity of Taree, which is in New South Wales. And that's where the intergrade zone starts to happen.
Okay.
And then that goes up to, so remember when we had
Darren
and he was talking about the Port Max? Yep. So there's Port Mac and here's Taree.
So Taree is where Diamonds
that's sort
stop.
Of where diamonds sort of stop.
Stop-ish, or it's where the intergrade zone begins, and then the intergrade zone continues all the way up to
Coffs Harbor.
Which is up here.
Whoa. Yeah, so that's all that zone.
And as we progress into Coffs Harbor, you start seeing higher percentage of coastals. Coastal blood animals or whatever.
Yeah, so that's the weird thing, right? I think like when it comes to the intergrade zone, I think Darren sort of tried to nail this point home. Diamond pythons are not interbreeding with coastal carpets, but it's sort of like in that area, they're sort of intergrades between. And so it's intergrades breeding with intergrades, and I think it was the Chavaglia papers that talked about diamonds and coastals and the presence of the intergrade zone and basically saying that those two taxa could be less closely related than originally thought. I don't know. I find that interesting. Maybe that's another group of, carpets that are one of those,
that
you know what I mean? Like one of those,
more, like, yeah, do they need to be peeled off on their own?
I don't know. So we have enough nonsense.
Please don't add another one. Please don't do it. Yeah.
Interestingly, the
Complete Carpet Volume 3, all intergrades. That's just the title.
There was, this is in the more Complete Carpet Python book. There was one specimen that was recorded from the banks of the Tumut River near Blowering, New South Wales. And this is at a location where it's on the western edge of the Great Dividing Range. And it's an area where the mountains begin to give way to the Murray-Darling Basin.
What were we doing over there?
So in the book, they talk about
there.
They talk about this single specimen was easily distinguishable from both the aforementioned taxa, and it was consistent with a diamond inland intergrade. So,
God damn it.
With only finding the one, it's really hard to sort of,
For all you know,
is that a one off? Is it, rather more? Got
picked up by a bird and dropped into Murray. I don't know. So
again, this would be something that I chalk up to a place that I would like to go to see if you could find such an animal, my trek to find all these weird carpet pythons that everybody sort of talks about. But if you want to talk about, so this is a wild Port Mac, and you can see sort of the, this is what in Australia they call, it's kind of almost like the best of both worlds, right? I mean, it's got
Is that that rainforest diamond thing?
So in captivity, I think the ones that are in captivity probably have been selectively bred a little more.
If
you look at the one that Darren has, it's basically yellow. It's like a yellow diamond python, which is nuts.
Yeah.
This is more of what I'm used to seeing as far as the wild ones go. Yeah. There was a couple other ones that I sort of took.
You can see the diamond influence. Yeah.
Yeah. You sort of have that. That's what I was sort of saying when we were talking about it with him. You can see it.
Yeah. You can see it. Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like a coastal and a diamond kind of mixed together almost, sort of like.
Oh, I mean, we look at it
black, sort of brown and tan.
Right.
The you know, there's
lots of liar, right? Yeah. It's
right.
It's one of those that we have seen enough that we look at it and we're like, no.
Yeah.
Not coastal nor diamond, something else. Yeah.
Right. But it's definitely distinctive, you know, definitely has a look. So, so you'll hear a lot of people talk about the intergrade zone and stuff like that. And I think there was this thing in the hobby way back in the early days of keeping carpets that it was okay to breed a coastal to a diamond and
because they
intergrade in the wild, you know, all those kind of stuff. You'll hear in Australia sort of like what Darren was talking about when he was talking with us about rainforest diamonds is kind of what they call them in the hobby. I think the other name for them is Port Max, if you will. So,
okay.
I don't know. I think, what do you think? So here's a question I have for you.
Yes.
This is sort of an overall carpet python question. What do you think is the reason why males that are smaller don't combat? And why do you think they combat if they're bigger? Do you think that there's like, why would they do that?
I don't know if a smaller diamond wouldn't want to even put it in the effort to combat, where he's like, he knows that like being in... it's almost like why would he combat? Like if two small boys are there,
yeah,
and they use all their effort combating each other, and then here comes the big guy who's this is his territory, kind of a thing. You know, why even put the effort into it? I think, but if you have two large males, it's almost like along the lines of younger mountain goats don't. They maybe do it for practice, but it's not. They don't really mean it until they start getting big and buff. And now you have to challenge the other thing. You have to prove that you're bigger than this guy. So I don't know if that's the same level or if it's just smaller ones are like, nope. I don't know.
I don't even know. I can't remember if they even talked about this in the carpet python book. I'm sure they did. And maybe I just don't remember, but I don't know. My thoughts were kind of like prey availability, right? Because if those males are, you know, same thing with imbricata. What if they're only able to pick off? So like, what if the prey that are big enough for the females to take down are not big enough for the males to take down?
Right. And
the females need all that nutrition for laying a clutch of eggs. Would make more sense for them. It's meaning that they only combat possibly because of the size that they are.
Mm-hmm. They have to throw their weight around and go, let's put it that way. You're a smaller snake. You can hide easier. You can find places that are warm easier. You can bask from a small little ray of sunshine that's coming through this. You know, you're a big snake. You have big snake problems. You need to have a big place to bask. You have to find a big, good meal. Like, you know, you got to do all that stuff. So maybe it's kind of a thing of to get the other male to get the hell out of here so that you can have the roof that you guys were both on or something like that. So,
I don't know. but if you have any thoughts on that, people out there, feel free. Just give us a comment or whatever. Send us a message. I don't know. Just thought it was interesting to think about. So what's their environment like? The Pacific Northwest is what I think of when I think of diamond python territory.
You're not wrong. It's like
temperate rainforest, sandstone canyons, rock escarpments. Mm-hmm. I think it just depends on the time of year. Interestingly enough, this past year, I don't know if it just was by happenstance or whatever, but I can't tell you that how many people I saw posting up pictures of diamond pythons close to the beach in these rock escarpments, kind of like that.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
Right?
I kind of like, can you imagine that as a background?
Yeah, dude.
So this is the background image of your cage, but you have built You have built the rock thing out of the back so that it looks like that, and the snake can, oh my God.
So for people that are listening, what it is there's this picture that was posted. I think I got it from Instagram. But basically, it's like a beach, but it's like a close up of this rock, and these rocks have these like little like cracks and crevices and whatnot. Kind of like what I would think a Ruffy or a Owen Pelly would be sort of doing.
Like, do you remember when we went looking for like, where Robert took us with the Nerodia and the milk snake? It's a small rock, cracks and crevices that are just packed full of snakes. Where in Pennsylvania, those snakes that are packed in there are milk snakes and, you know, water snakes. In Australia, they are diamond pythons. Like, it is,
I'm going to pay attention this year specifically to see if it happens again. I don't know. Like I said, it could be just, you know, you never know who's posting up pictures or whatever, but I seen at least, I think it was like at least 7 to 8 different pictures.
Look at that giant freaking coil at the bottom. What the hell of a monster is attached to that thing?
Right.
Holy crap.
What do you think? There's like maybe four at least.
Well, look at it, because you crammed
have into that crack.
You have this giant coil here, which is one. You have the tail that's sticking out here that looks different, two. You have the one on top of the giant coil that pattern is completely different, three. And then I don't know if that guy's any different or attached to anybody else, so I'm going to say four.
Right. Yeah. Probably right. I don't know if the other picture I have shows it. Let me see. Damn. It gives a different look. No, it's just let me show you this picture. It's kind of the same, but
now would you reach into that rock? Would you start pulling diamonds out of that rock?
Oh, hell yeah, man. Look, there's you can see its head popping out there.
Oh my God. Yeah, I'd take the hit. I'd get the diamonds out. Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Yep. Wow.
Yeah, very cool. That's cool. But you'll see them a lot in basking out on this rock escarpments and stuff. Yeah. There was so I found it interesting. There was a guy and he was talking about I don't know. Let me find it. Working this is a smoke event. No, basically, no. Like what?
Well, they're also the ones that we see most of the time in like people's houses or chicken coops or.
Yes.
Like they seem also very versed in being in people's living amongst people, you know?
Yes. Let's see. It was oh, here it is. They get around in the trees as well as they do in the rock outcrops of the habitat range occur in. Being most southern species of python in the world, they usually go into brumation when temperature drops dramatically in the winter months. Then they will usually head into a hollow or a rock crack crevice and see out the cooler winter months. They'll occasionally come out to catch the sun to warm up on warmer winter days when the sun is out. Mm-hmm. What was the other thing that they said? They're a species that is regularly encountered living in people's roofs. That live close to bushland or in their barns, their sheds. They're feeding on the rodents and they're keeping the pests under control, which is kind of a good thing. You kind of want them there. Unfortunately, one of the bad things about that is a lot of them get killed moving on the roads. There was a picture of one that was knocked out in the more complete carpet python that was incredibly beautiful. But I don't know. Cool snake, for sure. And I just love the fact that they're just hanging out at the beach. I don't know. I thought that was freaking cool.
I do love that. Yeah.
To the point where I told Rob when we go there, I definitely want to see if we can get to one of those beaches where they're hanging out. I think we have some intel on where that is. So we'll see. Like I said, their range sort of coincides with the most heavily populated areas in Australia. So they sort of are, you know.
Good move. Yeah, okay.
And the good thing about carpets and diamonds is that they seem to not be affected as much by human encroachment as, say, like woma pythons are affected by them. So,
well, again, it's one of those things that they're adaptable, and with us comes rodents and other food stuff and things like that. So,
yeah,
100%.
So, let's see. Basically, most of their habits are just based around the temperature and what's going on in the wild, as far as that goes. I think so. In some of the studies that I was able to get some natural history about, but they have an activity pattern typical of most carpet pythons, which is basically that sedentary lifestyle. They spend 50 to 80% of their time in one location. They move about 200 to 600 meters. Again, it depends on the season and it depends on the gender, right?
And what's driving that critter? Like, you know, hunting, breeding, all that fun stuff.
I think males were shown to move 120 miles plus or minus, maybe 50 miles, while females moved about half as much.
Jeez.
And the difference in distance traveled could be influenced by several other things. It could be habitat type. You know, it could be prey. You know, I don't know. There's multiple reasons why they would be on the move. Let's see what else about them. Males also have, there was another note that I took, more active are more active within their home ranges compared to females. The greater activity of males is at least partially due to the greater movement. Wait, hold on. I read that twice. The greater movement of males during the breeding season as they track down different females. So that's what males are probably on the move as well. To facilitate that, then this and that paper, it sort of talked about the male's home range overlaps of that with several females, which is kind of cool. They're ambush predators. They generally take a position near a trail. You know, sort of like I think of the famous Life in Cold Blood, David Attenborough, where he tapes the timber rattlesnake right at that base of the chipmunk trail, and the chipmunks running across the little branch there, and sort of think of, that's what I think of when I think of ambush predators.
Right. Sit and wait and here it comes and then I'll hit it. Yeah.
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 You know, they occupy, what was it? They sort of take a position, at least a day prior to capturing the prey. Juvenile diamond pythons are much more active predators and pursue much more often than adults. This is likely due to the small size and their higher caloric needs. So I think it was Richard Schein wrote in his book, More Snakes. What the hell is that book called? So Many Snakes.
So Many Snakes, a Little Time.
That's it. I'm trying to find the quote he said. I can't. I freaking highlighted it. Now I lost it. Damn it.
I'm still working through that. I can't help you.
Juvenile diamond python ambushes lizards by day until they grow large enough to ambush mammals by night.
Okay.
So I thought that was a little interesting tidbit that.
It makes sense.
Makes sense. Yep.
How many times have we seen some python, younger python species? It's like main thing for the younger guy is skinks, lizards, birds, stuff like that. Yeah. And then they kind of mature their way up into mammals and stuff like that. Or larger birds.
I think, Darren sort of hit on this too. He was talking about how in the springtime they tend to be more diurnal in behavior, and then they move to a more nocturnal lifestyle once the summer comes. The dark coloration, obviously, you know, similar to what we see with bolans, allows them to warm up rather quickly. Yep. They live, you know, they are able to sort of keep that, especially the larger ones will sort of retain that heat and allow them to hunt at night because they basically will, you know, they'll go undercover. They'll mm-hmm. you know, they'll just move their body or they'll, you know, sort of
hold on to the coil, stuff like that.
Yeah. And then I guess after they, after they bask, I think there's, you know, at least what I observe with mine and some of the people have talked about how they'll come out at the very beginning of the morning and they'll bask for a good hour or so. And then they'll sort of go about doing what they do. And then, mm-hmm. you know, maybe they're taking cover. Maybe, you know, I see like with mine, obviously it's not in the wild, but they'll come out and they'll bask under that light when it first comes on. I sort of have them going on and off all day. And then they'll sort of move to the corner and just sort of chill out. Sometimes they stay there where the heat is, you know, but oddly enough, I think I talked about this before, very arboreal.
Yeah. You know? All my designs for cages are like they're going to be very tall and stuff like that. Yes. Yeah.
So yeah, and that's the funny thing we talked about that even when it's cold, they're ready for food. And then I think the thinking is that the young diamonds are mostly taking skinks, probably various other geckos and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They're hunting during the day, and then. One of the crazy things was that Gary Vaillet, which is kind of what would you say, maybe the godfather of diamond pythons, at least
he has some good ones. Yeah. So, yeah.
I think he's retired now, but he's a very, very well known. He was somebody that I've tried to get on NPR forever, but
you need
to like, send a pigeon to somebody that gets a certain time.
Yeah. It's like how we have the NPR complaint department, which is the phone number for the payphone that's near the Dollar General near my house. Yeah. I have to be there and hear it ring and then I'll answer it. Yeah.
So, so there was the shivering thing, right? So diamond pythons, you know, sort of have been known to sort of shiver to sort of
raise the
clutch heat up, you know, the temperature of the clutch. They're able to do that. But Gary Vaillet, and he sort of mentioned this in the More Complete Carpet Python, was talking about how they he's noticed them shiver outside of that.
Hmm.
But wild ones have never been observed doing that. But so I don't know. I don't know what would make it do that.
I don't know. It's almost like they have that in their arsenal of something is if I get too cold.
Yeah.
Or if I'm not comfortable, I can always do this. And it's like, well, and they did. And it's like it's something to do. Maybe they won't necessarily see it in the wild because you have to find a wild one at the worst possible condition when it's like, I could do this right now. You know, I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe that's an indicator to sort of look at your temperatures or I don't know. Yeah. You know how like you go outside and you don't think it's going to be that cold. So you like rub your hands and together, so maybe it's just something as simple as that. It's sort of what you're saying.
I mean, it's also one of the things like, you know, I left the house this morning. It was cold as shit. I was wearing a hoodie. By the time I got where I was going, the hoodie went off because I'm like, and then when I got home later, I was like, I hate wearing jeans. Like it's temperature changes, dude. Like sometimes it just happened to be that one point where the thing was like a little cold. Just kind of, all right, I'm good.
Yeah. So, we talked about them. So basically what they eat in the wild is mammals.
Anything.
Yeah, well, they are known to take so big ones can take down large size meals. Here's a picture of one eating a possum.
So
you can get an idea.
Oh, sweet Jesus!
that's a big possum. Brush tail possum,
but that is not that large of a snake.
No,
it is
not.
That is the equivalent of giving one of my roughies back here a large rat. Like, could they do it? Sure. Do I want them to? No. Like, it is.
Yeah, you thing, know, I wonder.
Nobody better. I wonder if, that thing for a while, or it upchucked. I'm telling you right now.
I wonder if it's one of those things like when you're in the wild, you're the mind, like their instinct is just to sort of
hit it,
take what you can get.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it might not come again, you know? So
yeah.
Just get what you can. And if you, you know, it maybe sometimes forces them to sort of eat something that size, but
or grow. I mean, because there's always that thing that you see the growth spurts when you up their food. So maybe it takes that, it doesn't go, it holds on to it. Like, let's say that guy eats it and immediately retreats into a tree where he sits there for 2 months. Like, does nothing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he's going to grow. He's going to, that's a lot of food intake. But also, who's to say that, like, I doubt he aced another possum a week ago or 2 weeks ago. Like, for all we know, this is the meal that he finally got after winter and 2 months. And now he's going to eat this thing and chill for 2 months. And then maybe when he comes out, he'll try to find something else, but he'll maybe have to do some smaller things. Like, one big meal like this will probably do well for a snake for a while.
Yeah, I would think so. You know, I think of those African rock python gazelles, you know, they say it's like they're eating once a year, basically.
Because they choked down a goddamn gazelle and then curled up in a termite mound and went to sleep for 4 months. Like, it was,
That sounds like Shangri-La.
That sounds great. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. It's pretty cool that, you know, they can take big meals like that. You know,
and there's always the ones with like the diamonds on the back deck, and it's like, we haven't seen the cat in a while. It's like, okay, well,
yeah, I'm sure that there's a lot of that. I know rabbits they eat a lot of rabbits, possums, and rats, basically. Yep. Birds are a small part of their diet, in the wild, but, you know, I don't know, maybe
bats.
Why they wouldn't take, I don't know. I guess bats go down that far. I'm not really sure. I mean, I'm sure there's bats there, but not like, isn't the flying foxes more of a tropical type of, I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know enough, but I assume maybe.
Yeah.
I think if they can get a bat, they're not going to turn it down. I don't think they're going to like, oh no, this one's wings. Like, no, I think they're going to kill it. I mean, a lot of introduced species would probably be right in their wheelhouse.
Yeah. So, you know, we'll talk about the reproduction. So in the wild, they're basically, they're what we call springtime breeders. They basically are breeding in the spring. For in Australia, that's September and November. Basically is when you're going to see them breeding in there. The interesting thing that I find about it is that they sort of do these breeding balls, and I have plenty of pics to share to show exactly what they do. Now, granted, it's not the Canadian garter snake.
But say it's not like, but so there's one female in that mix and then everything else is a boy.
I don't know if we know for sure. It's just multiple animals.
It's just multiple diamonds in one place. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Here's another one that you can check out. You got this bunch here.
I'm sure they're blocks. Like, where's the breeding?
And then you got this one here.
Yep.
I don't think in the pictures that they're, but the pictures are taken when they would be breeding. So in that other one, there was three. So I don't know if,
well, that's the thing then. So like if this is all around the same, the time when they should be breeding, and the males are like, we found a female, and they're all just going to kind of hang out near her and maybe take turns trying to spur to see which one can lock in with her. Like, that makes a lot of sense, but you know, I don't know if I would call that I mean, you call that a breeding ball? Like, they're, like, I don't know if they're actively all trying to breed or at.
So there was a post that I saw when this, I started seeing this on social media, but basically the gentleman who I thought I had his name, but I don't have his name. But anyway, he said that he remembers 3 years ago finding three mating groups of diamonds within a couple hundred meters during a morning of field. He was doing field work, I guess. Mm-hmm. And they were in they were in New South Wales South Coast. It was interesting to watch a couple of males each follow individual pheromone trails laid down by the female along the ground and up an almost vertical climb to where she was located within a couple of other males were all top ridge. I find it interesting how men throughout the southern coastal region of Moraes Lota group are complacent enough to aggregate in mating balls without displaying any form of aggression towards each other, unlike their counterparts to the north, which appear to be the complete opposite.
They finally found a female, you know.
Yeah.
They're all chill. They're fine.
There was a paper by Marks Fitzgerald, which talks about the mating system between populations of Moraes Lota. You can look that up, on the Google machine to to get it. So,
blasted Google machine. Yeah,
I don't know. I haven't heard anybody in the hobby per se really talk about doing any kind of breeding balls or like using extra males
I think it's also because if she's laying down a pheromone trail and she's laying multiple pheromone trails down and then the males are kind of following it to find her and she's like, and you want this female to breed with this male, why would you put lay down one pheromone trail? If she lays down multiples, fine, just find her, like, and then the male will go looking for her. Like, I don't know about that one.
Oh, you're not breeding. You're not into the breeding balls. So
I just don't see the point. Of still it because, out. Oh, well, the point of it is in the wild. Sure, whatever. It makes sense that she would lay multiple trails, and all the males would show up trying to follow it to find the girl. In captivity, while we don't like introduce and have multiple males, it's like, well, why do that? It's not. I imagine if you had one male that you really wanted to breed with this one female. Why introduce a wild card of another boy? And it's like, so if you have two reduced patterns and the male maybe is not getting it done, you can throw another male in there to piss him off, but why leave him in there to potentially be the sire of the clutch? Like, that's not what you want to do. I don't really see the need for breeding balls for them in captivity.
So I referred to the Bible of the Carpet Python Bible. And I'm going to read this little excerpt right here. Yes, there is multiple Bibles. But this is the Carpet Python Bible. during the breeding season, females usually are attended by 1 to 5 males, which court together and breed without aggression during the spring months. And that was from Slip and Shine paper. Male diamond pythons travel more frequently during the spring months while searching for mates. One radio tracked female, which was being courted by two males, move 100 meters from her original location, after which both males tracked her to a new location. An additional two males were released at the original site 2 days later. These males also followed the scent trail to the female at the new location, suggesting strong chemical cues that males may follow to find receptive females. All five snakes spent 10 days together within a small area, during which time the female was observed breeding with two of the males, one of which she had been observed copulating with a month earlier. So.
All right. I mean,
but I think you're right. Obviously you don't have to do that in captivity, but I wonder if you get better results, maybe. I don't know.
I don't think so. I mean, you know, what was it? Garter snake breeders, they're not just like one girl, 12 males.
That's good point.
You know, that's a good point. You still get, like, the whole point is that you have
But don't they usually keep garter snakes all together? Like, isn't
only,
it?
We only know like one guy. We only know one guy that we can ask these questions to.
And Lake Chapala.
Yeah, well, he's just... And he seems to not have any problems. I know he has multiple... Does he have multiple pairs together?
Yeah, I think he does.
What's he doing he right like now? Call him. Yeah.
Get him on the horn.
Get him on the horn. Like, well, I think he's got adults and juveniles, and he keeps them all kind of together, but he only started with a pair, right?
I don't know. I think so.
I don't either. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. And we talked about them on Carpets and Coffee, but I guess we didn't go in enough.
We should really start listening when he talks. So, yeah.
Poor Lucas.
Yeah.
All right. So that's kind of the natural history of diamond pythons and what they do and how they do it in the wild. And, hopefully I get to see one this coming October in the wild. But we can transition to how they're kept.
A little slow tear rolling down my face as you find diamond pythons in the wild. But I'm so happy for you.
Yeah. Yeah. When I send you the pic, you'll be like, you mother.
That sounds great. I'm like, that's great. And then I'll put it down. You son of a bitch. Grab my pillow. Lay down. Cry. Yeah.
Yeah. So as far as caging goes, I think.
We've seen so many different caging options for them. It's ridiculous.
My approach is going to be. Multiple basking sites,
right?
Larger cage, definitely room to climb and to perch. Mm-hmm. I think I like the idea of somehow incorporating a nest box type of thing, similar to what Mike Stefani did with his Kimberly Rocks, where he had the rock looking egg box
that you can like pull out.
So that's an idea that I have. I think you definitely want to provide them. You could use a 4 foot cage, but I would definitely, if you're going to do that, I would definitely go at least.
Yeah.
I would say even what's like the tall, what's it, 18? It's got to be higher than 18 inches. I would think you would have to go, I would say almost 2 to 4 foot tall.
There's a couple companies out there that are starting to do higher cages.
Odd sizes.
The general like bread and butter is 16 and then 18.
Yeah. I think so. That top one is 18.
Yeah.
And I can put a perch in it, as you can see that perch right there.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But I still don't think it gives it enough room for basking. And I think that's really why I would say to try to go as tall as you can. Because you really want to provide that basking spot for them, because I think that it's just part of what they, how they,
there's,
just a part of how they are, you know.
There's an animal plastics cage that is 72 wide, 24 deep, 48 high.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say that.
Yeah.
How much does that go for?
$825.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
I mean, some people build them. And like I said, if you're keeping one, you could probably, I don't know.
I guess
4 foot is the sort of that's been done that size. And I'm sure you could keep them in size. But I think with that, the most important thing you want to look at is just a thermal gradient. They really need to be able to get away from the heat and really get that hot basking temperature.
Close to the same sizes, because we always say like 48 wide. Mm-hmm. So they are ones that are about $500. It's 48 wide, 24 deep, 36 high.
Yeah.
And again, this is just one cage builder. There's so many out there.
So many.
Oh my God. I think Dubia.com had a bunch that I was looking at where like you always want, I always want the ones where like the people are inside and they're like, yay. I'm like, excellent. Yes. Yeah, good enough. Yeah. So not that I'm looking, preparing and planning, you know, for diamonds.
Right.
Patiently waiting.
What would you get rid of to get diamonds if you had to get rid of
nothing?
Nothing? Nothing?
Oh, well, all right. No, water pythons. I hate them. But the short list is the water pythons, the Jungle Jag Project, Kribo. There's a couple things that I'm like, get out. just like, and I just haven't pulled the trigger yet because I'm waiting for egg season to be done. When egg season is done, and I know for a fact that there aren't eggs coming out of certain things, they're gone. The other problem is with the Jungle Jag project. Eliminating that means I have to deal with trying to place the ocelot Jungle Jag that is Jag with a capital J, and it's just like.
You need another Owen.
I need the next level, and you know it's. Yeah. But yeah, there's a lot of that stuff, but that's so many other things. Like, but it's like planning ahead would be like they wouldn't even be in the snake room because I wouldn't have to try to make room for them there. It's like having to do a completely different thing. Like we're talking, I got to get 10-gallon tanks and set them up in the living room when they're babies. Yeah. Like we have to do that. This is new ground that needs to be paved. Like, and I'm looking at adult cages and I'm like, it's going to take them years to get into that. It's like,
yeah, I don't know. You know what? Hold on one sec. I'm going to take it real quick.
There's a lot of that kind of stuff. I mean, that's the other thing is I've seen your setup so long. So setups. I just forgot that you were not having your headset on when you did that. So I was still talking, but you couldn't hear me.
No, I couldn't. What did you say?
I've seen your setups before, like when you've taken babies and those little nano exoteras and stuff like that, and then how you progress through to eventually they're big enough to go in a four footer. And it's like, well, I would do that. And then with the time you would go to the four footer, there would just be the big cage and they would all just go together. And it's like, yes, that, or I'll find adult diamonds. I'm not spending that money. No, sir. So
this is my, I'll walk through, I'll put the picture up and then I'll walk through what I have.
Yeah.
Look at that little Carpet Fest logo in the background.
Yes. Yeah. I love that. So that's Nano Exoterra. Yep.
Yeah. So this is what I would do for a hatchling to, you know, if once you get it settled in. So I got a UV light that goes across the top.
Yep.
And then I have this little basking bulb in the back. I have branches. This is a basking spot. That's the basking spot. I got some cover here. I got a little hide back here. And
you got some soil and.
Yeah, it's cocoa fiber husk.
Oh, yeah, cocoa fiber husk.
Here's the other side. You can see the sort of a similar type of thing.
Yep.
Yeah, that's sort of what I keep the young ones in. And then as they grow, I put them in. There's are on the four footers over there. I don't know. Like, that's kind of, I don't have any other heat on it. my room is probably fluctuates in the winter, goes down to maybe 60. I open the window, it gets to 50. And if I during summertime, it's probably the 70s. Obviously, this is down the lower level of the house. So the air conditioner goes on in the summer and all that. But I keep this door room closed, so you know, I got that. But that's sort of my basic setup. Sort of pretty simple. Nothing crazy.
No,
I think if I were to breed them, I think I would try to get like a rack like that and maybe get a bunch of exoterras and probably maybe one that's not that big, but maybe they would be like the hold back cages and then underneath would be, you know, like the smaller ones.
Yeah.
For ones that I would, you know, sell or give away or whatever it is.
I mean,
do you give away everybody? Well, I mean,
people are asking me if I should just come over and kidnap your diamonds, but I keep going, I have faith in him.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Well, you know, we'll see how they go. But that's sort of how I do it. I think basically you have to think about the ambient ventilation is important because you want that heap to be able to escape. I have everything on timer, so it's coming off. I sort of have it follow, except for the adults, because I have them come off and on. I think I have them first come on when the sun rises. I think I leave it on for 2 hours. I'll have it cut off. Now, meanwhile, there's UV that's on the whole time.
All time during the day, right?
When I get the bigger cages, I would like to have it to where I have those new I forget what it's called. That new thing that Arcadia put out where it's like,
yes, the light bars. Yeah.
Mm. Yes. Yes.
So they're like, it lights up and it gradually, yes. I'm like, stop it.
Yes.
Stop it. Uh-huh. You know, I'm watching this and I'm watching your, I love it because your setup for Diamonds mirrors Rob's new setup for Rhino.
100%.
Yes. Oh my God. And it's like, it's the same kind of exoterras, the light things, this, that. And I'm like, they all seem to, oh my God, it seems like the cooler animals. The animals that like it cold seem to do the same fucking thing. Like it.
Yes.
So yeah, you would basically, for Diamonds, I would set up what Rob's doing, various exoterras of different sizes, all the same kind of lights. And then eventually you put them in either a large ass enclosure or a big enough cage that you can have perching in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. God damn it.
And again, they're beautiful snakes.
I know.
So, you know, it's that's like
the problem is that I'm like, I can do Diamonds. I just throw cages there. I don't want cages there. I want more visual. I want glass. Like I want to see them. And I'm like, I'm going to end up having to buy a fucking custom acrylic tank or some bullshit. Like it's going to be, it's annoying. Yeah. So
I think ventilation is, I think in general for reptiles, that ventilation is a lot more important than people focus
just so you're
on.
Aware for these in particular. Aware of how bad it's gotten, I looked up shower stalls that you can get, like those ones that like you can that are like almost for like RVs shower stalls, so that it could just be a dome curved thing. Yeah, because some monitor people do those, and I'm like, I can figure that out. What is wrong with me? Like, it's,
we've broken Owen.
Yes, not good. It's not good over here.
So, like, anyway. I think a common mistake that people make with diamond pythons, we've talked about this before on the show, but I think one of the biggest things that they do is that they think about cooling diamond pythons down when it's wintertime, but their natural environment is much cooler. Mm-hmm. And you have to provide that colder than normal temperatures, kind of year round, you know?
Yeah.
It's what's thought to sort of contribute to the diamond python syndrome thing, but they should be kept at lower temperatures year round, not just during the breeding season.
Right.
The trick is, from what I've found, is that it's that basking spot. And, you know, I'll sort of talk about, so I don't know how we should do this. I'll sort of talk about it. Like so this is my breeding strategy. And I took this right from the more complete carpet python book. Right. Mm-hmm. So, but this sort of equates to how you would keep them year round. Now, I tend to disagree with some of the people that keep them warmer all the time. Like they, when they're young, they're keeping them warmer.
And then they don't subject them to anything until they get older.
Any kind of night drops or anything like that. I think that works with a lot of pythons, not them. Yes. Yeah. And I think that, you know, I don't know. You just have to be aware of what you're feeding and how you're feeding. And, you know, you sort of have to have everything go together and not just pick and choose little things from people's care regimens, you know, because the whole thing that they do is what matters, as opposed to like these little things that you know, like you don't have to have no heat. You can keep them at ambient temperature, but there's a lot more that goes into that.
No. That was like, and that's something I say with rhinos too, where it's like, they like it cold. Yes, but it's still a reptile. Like
it's
almost like you read the chapter title, but you didn't read the chapter. Like you have to, like, you know, they can keep them at room temperature. You should provide a basking spot. Oh, like you have to, it's the next step. So
Gary Valle in the book, he talks about, and I think Josh does this, I think there's probably quite a few diamond breeders, but they're saying for the first 18 months of life, they have the basking site on 24 hours. And you're looking at an 84 to 88 type of basking, you know, typical carpet python basking spot.
Yeah.
And the ambience probably 68 to 77, somewhere in there. So the ambient is much cooler than.
Well, yeah, but if your ambient is 60 to 70, like that's your house. Like that's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is probably why they do so well in people's
rooms. Oh, my goodness. In
basements,
houses.
Like, and sheds. And, you
know. Keep looking in my bay. I keep looking in my roof and I keep not finding a diamond python. I don't know what's wrong.
He talks about having basking site available for 7 to 10 hours a day. So this is where I would agree. Like maybe you have to leave that basking site on for longer when they're younger because they're eating more often because they're eating also, skinks and stuff like that. So they're eating smaller meals until we talked about
like they're small, their impact where they are. It might be really hot in that area until they get bigger and kind of start venturing forth out of safety. Like, you know, it's that whole thing. But also, I don't know if I'd be okay with being like, congratulations, you've hatched, experience nighttime. Like, maybe don't like just start whacking. Like, you know, that's the thing is that people are like, it happens in nature. And not a lot of things survive in nature. Like maybe you don't want to like deep six a diamond python right off the bat. Like,
right. Yes, so. That is true. That is a good point. That is a good point.
Just because it's done there doesn't mean they would survive.
You know that like only two out of the clutch live to adulthood.
Right? That's on average. Most of the clutches just don't. Like
So I would say that I feed the younger ones probably when I got newborn, like they were babies. I was feeding them probably every week in the summer months, and then I basically would start to gradually move off of that. As soon as you would get into the end of fall, you know, and then once I drop the temperatures, again, I'm providing that basking spot. So if I notice that they're just looking, I'll offer them a meal, but I'm really not feeding them that. So it's sort of like paying attention to your snakes.
It is. It's like, you know, I got the Savus today again. Uh-huh.
Nice.
And it was one of those like set them up and they're all over the place. I'm like, I'm not feeding me. You guys can chill. You guys will sit, chill, and then I'll feed. And it's like earlier or a little bit earlier, right before I got and started doing the show, the male was out and set in ambush position. And I'm like, okay, so I probably could have, but I'm not gonna. It's it's that whole thing of that watching. And like I told you, this rough scale behind me, the one on the top, she's getting ready to light me up if I open that door because she's ready to roll because she missed dinner. Everybody else ate. So it's just kind of weird like that. It's like if you kind of watch them, you're just like, now is a good time to offer you food. Like, here you go. Yeah.
I do notice, especially with the ones in the Exoterras, like right now, I don't see them at all because I think that one's going into shed. But as soon as it comes out of shed, it'll come up and it'll do the chondro pose thing.
Yeah.
And as soon as I see that, I offer them a meal, you know, until I start seeing them move around.
We all know what ambush position in a python looks like. If you don't know what ambush position in a python looks like, the Google machine will tell you. And they all look the same. It's just the python changes.
Yes.
You know,
exactly. Yeah. Sometimes they're green. Sometimes they're green, and they got
spots.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's like, you know, it's a Timor python. Like, it doesn't matter.
Right. Yeah. So I would say, like, here's another awesome thing about diamond pythons. I think when they become mature, they eat probably every 6 weeks. So you're looking at an adult female is probably getting a maximum of 8 to 10 meals a year.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Again, we've talked about this many times. If Owen could redo everything.
Right.
Can you imagine the food bill if it just had diamonds? Like,
yeah. And we sort of talked about the age of where they would breed, 4 to 5 years, 5 to 6 years, 4 to 5 years for males, 5 to 6 for females, somewhere in that area.
I fear I'm going to be a reverse Keith McPeak, where instead of having, like, he kind of gets rid of all the breeding stock and then just kind of gets what he wants. I'm going to get rid of all this stuff and just do diamonds. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love diamonds, man. They're very cool. And we'll get into the pricing and all that kind of stuff. So basically, this is what I've done this year so far. And I sort of... So once the fall came around, my photo period was 10 hours. And I was feeding regularly at the time. And basically the basking temperature was like maybe 80 to 85, 86, somewhere in that area, 88, something like that. Ambient temp, you're looking at the low 70s. And then the nighttime temp in the fall would probably dip down into the high 60s, you know, somewhere in that area, right?
Makes sense. Yeah.
Winter would come around. And I think to me, from what, from everything that I've read, really it's the photo period, the basking spot length that you're really messing with. And then obviously the ambient temps will cool down. But I dropped that from 10 hours to 6 hours. And then there's no feeding during the winter.
Right.
Basking temps have dropped a little bit, maybe 78 to 80 degrees, right? Ambient temps have dropped down to the low 60s, mid to, low to mid 60s. And then the nighttime temp is really where it gets crazy.
Yep.
50. Somewhere 50 to 60 degrees. And you're just like, what the hell? This is just insanity.
Like, I don't know if I should be doing this anymore. And it's a colder. Yeah. It's
so,
we're in April, very close to April.
Yes. So
what's the next step?
All right. So what I've started to do is I've moved the, and this is a gradual thing that again, with the technology of, having, you know, plugs, smart plugs and all this stuff that you can sort of just set this and it automatically happens, which is freaking fabulous.
Love it. Yeah.
Fantastic. So I went from 6 hours to gradually increasing to 10 hours. So right now, currently we're at 10 hours.
10 hours of basking time.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And that basking temp is 80 to 85. So it's still not, pumping out like it would in the summer. And you know how I've controlled that is by the wattage of the bulb.
Bulbs. Okay.
Yeah. So I'll like gradually reduce the wattage of the bulb. I don't know. I assume, you know, they have those, what are they?
The infrared, the red ones?
Heat projector thing.
Ceramic.
I guess. Yeah, well, it's like that one that Arcadia makes, but I think you could probably control the heat that's coming out of that. I'm sure that there's bulbs that you can control that. You could put a control the temperature.
Even the heat emitters and stuff, if you hook it up to the right stat, if it's just a ceramic, it's like having a radiant heat panel.
Yeah.
It heats up and gets to a certain point and it dims and it, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I find that when you provide the – so I had the one on the bottom cage is now empty, but that was the last one that I had as far as a radiant heat panel in it. The other four that are here all have bulbs. And I find that when the radiant heat panel, they didn't bask as much.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they're attracted to that light. I don't know. I don't know if it maybe
Would you consider a radiant heat panel in a spot just as almost like a safety net? Like if it gets to a certain point, it would turn on and then have a basking bulb in another spot kind of a deal?
Maybe like have it to where the see, to me, I would almost feel like that radiant heat panel would almost control the ambient temperature.
It would. So like,
you're like a safety net. Like if I'm opening my window and it's 40 degrees outside, you want to make sure.
Give me 10 more degrees, baby. Like it's like, you know how we would see, you'd have the basking bulb and then at nighttime you'd have the red bulb.
Yeah.
And a Red Bull with that. Well, maybe I don't want to have my living room bathed in a red glow in the middle of the night as people can see through. Yeah. Like, you know, maybe I don't want to do that. So,
oh, I get you. So you're using the radiant heat panel.
No. Right. If I swap out the red bulb and you have the basking light and then the heat panel, if you programmed it the right way, if you had the stat programmed the right way with maybe even if it was like, say, it was the Herbstat 2.
Yeah.
Or even just a Herbstat 1. Herbstat 1's on the panel, timer's on the bulb, and you got the right wattage for the bulb. If you have that program that it turns on almost like you reverse the day night drop
or yeah.
the temps, and it's like, well, bulb goes off, panel comes on.
Right.
And the panel keeps this thing a certain warmth or a certain thing for that. But it's like, I don't know if it would have enough to do. Like, it would be like, the yeah. point, I don't know if I would be able to sit there and be like, yes, yes, give me, again, like, give me 10 more degrees, baby. Like, I don't know yeah. if that is necessarily a thing. So,
yeah. So, as we go into, so did I finish out spring? So 10 hours yep. feeding is
10 hours,
sort yep. of back to regular basking right. spots, low 80 to, you know, low 80s to mid 80s, something like that. Right. Right. Ambient temperatures like high 60s, low 70s, and nighttime temperature is now in the 60s, right? Okay. So it's sort of graduated to the 60s. And got again, it. The ambient temperature, luckily in this room, sort of, I don't have to really do anything, but I do have up on top of the enclosure, I have a humidity temperature type of thing, and I can look at that, and it'll tell me what the temperature in the room and all that kind of stuff. So, what is it? Gobi, I think it is. Is
the I love how you have ones. All these, like, I remember you going through these things. You're like, this thing will tell me this, and it's like, I'm like, yeah, Eric got them all throughout his snake room. They're all on the diamonds. Everything's on the diamonds. Like all the wonderful
kind of
gizmos he got are all on the diamonds. Carpet.
Yep.
And like, yeah, just yeah. do whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. These are the high-end carpets, man.
What temp is it? They're fine.
It's yeah, like, they're good. Let's see. So after that, so basically I keep them in the winter thing for like mm-hmm. 3 months. So basically January, February, March, and now we're starting to bring them back up, right? Yeah. So about 3 to 6 weeks after bringing them up to normal temperatures, females should start to have follicular growth.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of at this point, the introduction should begin. Now, where I'm sort of torn is I don't know whether or not I should feed them and then introduce. I've heard some people say introduce first. And then start to feed.
Feed them first. Well, I let's put it this way. Thaw out the rats and then see what everybody's doing. Like,
well, I know what they're going to be doing.
Exactly. If you thaw out the rats and the males are like up against the glass doing this, and then you open it up and they're still like doing this and they're not paying any attention.
Yeah.
Fine. Feed the girls. Like, see who wants to eat. Offer food.
Yeah.
Because yep. I would rather do that than have it where everybody's hungry and you put it in there and the female bites just because there's movement.
Yeah.
So I would say feed first, chuck everybody in right after, like the next day.
And this is sort of what you do with the brettles?
I do that with everybody, dude. Like okay. that's right. across the board.
Well, yeah, yeah.
You know, I trust no one. No one. Like I've seen white lips latch on each other. I've seen colubrids. No. Everybody yeah. gets food, and then when everybody's full, then you can meet your partner, okay? Like, nobody's going in there hungry.
Right, exactly. So I think that's what I'm going to do. That's my instinct is telling me right. that to try to offer food and just get them
because
going.
Then
and,
also, you know. It's a good barometer because if you go and you show a rat to your boy, and your boy is like, I'll eat anything in sight, and he's just like, get this thing the hell out of my way.
Yes.
Then you're on the right path. Like, my male Ruffy, he will eat every time. He ain't right. eating right now. I mean, right now he wants girl.
He wants females. Yeah.
I mean, he took, but this is the first time he's taken in like a month. Uh-huh. And he's so weird because we had such a long season last year. I don't know where he's at. So he took, he dropped it. And he didn't eat. And I'm like, all right. So I don't know if you're fully feeling it out here. So, yeah. That's just how it goes. If the male don't want it, you're on the right track.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I do know. I did notice. So the male is in the lower one.
Yeah.
And he sort of has
always
been
put the boys
moving
the
around. moving around. He's out yep. of out.
Well, it's good with mulch, too, because you'll see Like he'll push all the
mulch the divots back. And shit. Yeah, exactly.
Like, ah, yes, good. He's trying to get, yeah, that's how it goes.
You'll notice that it's like they do that push where they're trying to, like, you know, like
they're like, they anchor themselves. Get this, and needs to open.
Fly back. Yeah, right. Yeah. So, basically, at that point, I think at that point, once you've sort of, you know, you're introducing the males and with the females. I think I would probably keep them together like I do carpets. I don't really separate mm-hmm. them, but I guess if you were going to do two females and one male, maybe you would probably give them a couple days rest in between going back and forth.
Well, you know, introduction, and then again, we talked about this, like what you do, there's no formula. Yes. You cannot sit there and be like, and in 6 days, no matter what is happening, I will pull them apart. Like, obviously, if you go in there and you're like, I'm going to pull them apart, and they're like on top of each other and he's courting her, leave them the hell alone. Like, it's like that whole thing. It's, you know, and if you go in there day two and she's here, he's there, and or he's running around the cage trying to get out again.
Right.
You act accordingly. So, yeah.
So yeah, at that point, I think it's probably 1 to 2 months after that, the female will ovulate, and then it's just normal carpet python, you know, pre-lay shed.
Okay.
Lay the eggs.
You tested out your incubator yet?
My incubator?
Yeah. Yeah. The last time that puppy was plugged in, rolling.
2020.
Maybe, 21. Maybe plug it in. Maybe just try to. Hear the words I'm telling you.
I don't make that mistake twice, man.
I'm a little bit further away now.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if I would be able to keep them warm. Although I think you would almost want my clutch to go south so that you'd be like, bring them here.
You're right.
Bring them here. There's a fee eggs. Now.
18 eggs
has upgraded.
18 eggs, how many hatched for? What?
Four. Terrible rate.
What's in those cages? Don't open those. So, yeah.
Don't worry about that.
That does not concern you.
That's highly venomous cobras. Don't touch that.
What are you doing working with cobras? Mind your business, that's what.
Son of a bitch. Oh, great. So, yeah, and then after that, it's kind of there. I, you know, the interesting thing about diamonds, they are sort of, you know, nest builders type of deal. I think similar to like king cobras and stuff. Some of the studies that they did, you know, to lay eggs in the wild is kind of crazy. And there was a paper that talked about, I think this was Shine and Fitzgerald talked about, the female loses about 48% in body weight.
Jeez Christ. That's a lot. That's a lot.
So right now I'm at like 210 pounds. So I would be down to like 105.
What? Oh my God.
Can you imagine? Oh my
God.
Poor that's girls.
Like that's what like actors do for movie roles when they need to play a heroin addict. So like it is. Yeah. No.
So I think what did it say? 2/3 of the loss was due to the egg mass, but the wild female lost about 16% body mass as a result of. And remember, they're maternally incubating the eggs in the wild, so they're basically 2 months they're sitting on those eggs, and yeah.
I don't know if prey would present it like it. If a diamond female in the wild sit on the eggs and a prey item comes by, if they would snag her, if they would let it go.
Yeah. I think there's they tend to believe that they're probably every 2 to 3 years is what they would breed in the wild.
Right.
You know, and obviously carpet pythons are very well adapted. They've adapted the thermogenesis? Is that what it's called? Where it's sort of like, well, you know, vibrate and, you know, like what we were talking about earlier, raise the temperature of the eggs. I think they probably lay their eggs mostly in like under thick vegetation, maybe in like, you know, maybe up in Tree Hollow, you know what I mean? Like, you know, those kind of situations. I wouldn't know if they would lay them in rocky outcrops, because I would think that they wouldn't have the humidity, maybe. I don't know, but I guess
it depends on what's in the rocky outcrop. Like, if it's just if it's just rock and stuff like that, maybe no. But if there's like dirt and debris and leaf litter that's been blown in there over the years, maybe it's a good spot to kind of be in.
Right. And yeah, I think, let's see. Mm-hmm. They method of increasing temperature. Well, yeah, we talked about that. anyway, I guess for at that point, you would hope for X, and, you know, think everything else as far as like temperatures and everything, as far as carpet python eggs, mm-hmm. you know, is from what I see with diamond python eggs. I think the trick is just getting the eggs. And once you get the eggs, it's kind of, you know,
you're setting them up and see how it goes. Yeah.
Yeah. I think they can be a little tricky to get going. I've heard mixed reviews on this. You know, Darren was just talking about last week where he didn't have as much struggles with that whole situation, but some people do. I've heard that they're definitely eating skinks in the wild when they're young, so maybe that's mm-hmm. why that they're averse to it. But right. remember, Darren, didn't he say about offering them like a hopper?
Yeah, which is
like kind of like what you do with bread lye, right?
Right, I mean, right. Yeah. If they won't, they maybe won't take a frozen thawed fuzzy.
Oh no, it wasn't Darren. It was Buddy that we were talking to about it.
Yeah, Buddy said that.
Yeah,
but it was like going straight for the live hopper or the larger prey atom than you would normally go with. Seems tends to get them going.
Yeah.
So, and again, I think that's a year to year. Basis kind of a thing too, because I've had clutches of bread lye where you do have to go to that live hopper thing, but then this year's bread lye, they all Nothing. Took fuzzies right off the bat. So
see, that's the shit that fascinates me. So I would be curious to know.
And sometimes I don't know, dude, like it's the cosmic octopus.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder all my rhinos didn't start on fish this year. So like,
one of the things that I'm going to try is maybe take a couple of them and try to feed them at night as opposed to the majority of them feeding during the day.
Right.
And see if there's a difference, because in the wild, they're feeding during the day. Right. So mm-hmm. maybe that's something similar to like what they do with chondros. You know, Buddy talked about that a long time ago on NPR.
Yeah.
He was saying that he feeds mostly during the day when young chondros, which would make sense. Their prey is out during the day, you know. So
I remember working at the zoo and we had emerald tree boas, and I was told to feed them at night with like a red headlamp and stuff like that, because that was when they were active and that's when they were feeding. And if you woke them up, they just got too squirrely. So, but of course they were in like acrylic cages with like acrylic perches, and there was nothing else in that cage but like an acrylic tubes and a heat panel on the back, and then like a big water bowl on the bottom. And it was like, so what does it do all day? Like, it just like what can it do? Like, looking back, those cages sucked. Like, it
was the amateur days. So I think that's kind of like the natural history of them and keeping them and breeding them and whatnot. I think the only other thing I would hit on is when it comes to diamond pythons, they sort of have a weird. Let's just say that they're probably the most diehard purists of the carpet python complex. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You know? I'm not saying in a bad way. I understand why they are like that. But there was a lot of debate. A lot of debate on what's pure, what's Everything. Not pure, blah, 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 blah. You know, Nick had talked about on the, what was he on, Carpets and Coffee, and he said this. But he said that he's had all of the lines, the blood lines. Sheds tested, and basically there is little difference between them genetically.
Which makes sense. They're all just various lines of diamond. So, yeah.
Yes. I tend to believe that they're sort of like, and we sort of talk about this with Buddy, that they're sort of like, here's a group of snakes that I've brought, and they're going to various people. You know,
right?
They're going to this zoo and this zoo.
Would this zoo like them and this zoo would like? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Or The other possibility is that where they were collected from,
it's all around.
Yeah. So who knows? That's the thing. Who knows? You know,
right. We can't go. We don't have GPS tag location of these animals that were collected at this time in this place. And that equals this line. Like the San Diego Zoo did not personally go and get these things and tag where they were from. And they didn't only collect two. Like it was that whole thing. It's hard. People seem to think that that's the way it was and that that's how everything pieces out, but it really doesn't.
I tend to think there's also a lot of secrets when it comes to the diamond python world. It's hard to sort of find out some of that information that's sort of known by maybe the hardcore diamond people as opposed to, well, meaning that they, you know, for instance, I think in San Diego Zoo, that it's sort of Gosford locality type. I don't know if that's something else that the San Diego Zoo sort of like, maybe they traded with another zoo that they got that locality, which is possible. I really don't know that info.
Maybe one of those things where it was like they at one point, because sometimes the zoos have like a bunch and they're like, ah, we'll get rid of a bunch. And then something happens like, ah, crap, we only have like two. And then they got to go get more. Like it was never like, I really doubt they only brought them in once, especially back in the days when we were still trying to figure stuff out. Like there could have been multiple infusions of different diamonds and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Especially. 100%. And the other thing is that where, how zoos work with stuff is,
yeah,
if they have it and then they're like, I need it. And then another zoo sends some stuff over. It's like, well, where did that zoo get their stuff?
Right.
So, and that currently, other times back way back in the day, they would be like, Hank Molt, we need more. And then how that would come. So,
So I think if I were to give a sort of a snapshot of the various bloodlines or lines, you'll see these little abbreviations. So SDZ would be San Diego Zoo. Riverbank Zoo would be RBZ. Gary Valle would be GV. Then there's the Cypress Creek and the Geb Bailey stuff. So again, some people look at that as an unpure line. But Nick has Cypress Creek. I know Brandon Wheeler had talked to the guy that was actually responsible for that. And he sort of had, he felt confident that they were pure, as pure as you could, I guess.
Oh, that's the thing is, I guess, but it's where do you want to draw? Where's your line that you want to draw? How far do you have to go back before you be like, and that anything beyond this, I don't trust. It's like, okay. So I don't know.
Yeah. out of all of the carpet pythons, it seems that diamond pythons are the ones that are most, I don't want to use the word fanatical, like, cause that's sort of a negative term, but like, I'm thinking of it in a positive term to where they're really tried to protect their bloodlines, if you will, to say like mixing it with a jungle jag to get the gamma jag type of thing, it would be like sacrilege to
a lot of diamond python.
You know, I don't know. It's sort of like what we talked about at the beginning of the show. I showed that picture of that one that looks like a jungle carpet. So I don't know, man, until I see them in the wild, I'm sort of going to hold back on my thoughts on whether or not. But these are the line; these are sort of the established lines, right? And I think the one thing is, like, if you want to get into diamond pythons with the idea of breeding and then being able to sell said stock, the more lineage info you can have on the animal, the better off you're going to be. Because I think the person that's coming into diamond pythons is probably going to want to know that information. And I guess at the end of the day, my recommendation would be not going to, if you're going to try to get into diamond pythons, just don't buy one at a show that's on Brando's table.
Exactly.
You know, that would be my advice. You know, just go to a breeder.
Right. I mean, how many times have we seen, and I've seen this, I've seen it, I've been offered it, where it's like Diamond Python. What's the line? Gary. I'm like,
yeah.
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, of course. That makes total sense. Yeah.
Right.
And it's like, and most of the time when you see diamonds or something like that at a show and they're on a flipper table, it's because they bought out somebody's collection.
Correct.
And that's, and they're going off of what they asked the person, and the person is going off of either they have breeder information. And this is why I love having all the phone numbers and things of various breeders, because I've been in the situation where, like, it's from this guy. Oh, yeah? Picture. Did you make this? Send.
Yes. Right. No.
Hell no. Okay, well.
Like, yeah.
There's that thing. But if this is so important to you, you should go to a breeder, and you should do that. And, you know, there's no such thing as a really good $200 diamond python.
No, diamond pythons are somewhat pricey.
Yes.
Yes.
And for good reason. So you have to be prepared for that.
I think
won't pull the trigger. pull the trigger on the roughy, but can't pull the trigger on the diamond. Like, yeah.
Well, you're hoping that I make them.
I am. So
hopefully. I would. That's sort of like, I hope that you made them. So I'm like, oh yeah, I could pull the trigger on the roughy, but
but Owen's right there. Yeah.
he's gonna breed him again. Let me just wait. You know,
it's the worst relationship ever. It's like, yeah, I don't need to do that. It's fine.
Yeah, you know, you get the stuff that I don't have, then you know I get the stuff that you don't have, and it kind of works out. Well.
Like people are like, why don't you get inlands? Eric's got inlands. whatever.
You'll get them eventually. So top breeders in the U.S. And again, this is not, I'm not trying to
We're
put any shade on anybody if I forget anybody, but obviously probably the most well-known is Gary Valle, but he doesn't breed them anymore. But a lot of his stock is out there, right?
Right.
I don't know. So I know Todd and Kerry were big breeders.
They were breeding some. Yes.
But they're out of it now, right?
They're out of it now. And I'm unsure of where their animals went.
So, yeah,
but there's where Gary's stock.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm just going to focus on people that I know
are have breeding,
bred them currently, and
right
and breeding. So you got Greg Heim.
Yep.
Most of everyone, but my Riverbank Zoo came from Greg for me. So he has worked with Josh Easter, who's another guy. I actually bought diamond pythons early on, and I, similar to you, they didn't do good because I kept them raw. And you know, learning lesson, whatever. But my first ones came from Josh Easter. Dave Kelly, he's another one. He breeds diamonds probably. I think he breeds them probably every year. He has awesome bloodlines. He has some really stellar animals and solid lineage and all that stuff. I think Tony Hurt, he does both crosses and pure stuff, if
yes, I'm not mistaken. I think it's what he said, is that he was doing that. I'm not sure what he's doing currently, but I think he's done them in the past.
Right. You got Martin Rosemond, which, by the way, I'm going to put a link in the show notes for you guys to go check out his blog that he did on Whose Line. It's called Whose Line Is It Anyway? He sort of goes really in depth to
the lines.
Different lines and stuff. Nice. There's a couple that we didn't talk about that they're probably, there's the, is it the Gunthenberg Zoo line that's over there in Europe? I know at one point Casper Christensen had a line, right? There's the Gosford locality, and obviously probably the rarest that you can't find anymore is the Lasik stuff. I know Dave Kelly has Lasik stuff. So again, that's why he has really good stuff. Top notch. But if you really want to go in depth and sort of like get a feel for it, just go follow that link, check out the blog that he does, and you can sort of see, like, he talks about, you know, all the different lines and where the you know, what he has in his collection, and you know, what he thinks is what. So I would definitely check that out, because I don't want to get into, like, you know, which line is pure or not pure and all that stuff, but
right.
I think, I hope I'm not I feel like I'm probably forgetting people. I know there's some people that are coming up with them. I know Tom Crutchfield, he breeds them in Florida.
Yep. Buddy Buscemi has
Yeah,
he has several available right now on Morph Market. So
right, I don't know if Brandon Wheeler is breeding them this year.
Brandon's working on his. Lucas is working on his. I think Nick got a clutch recently, or last year, or 2 years ago.
I think so. Yeah,
I don't remember. Yeah, there's a couple. I mean, you'll find some good diamond breeders out there, and they're
Yeah, I think sometimes people don't, maybe they don't get involved with them because of they kind of feel that maybe those the purists are too uptight about things. You know, I've seen that with, like,
you know, you can always stop listening to those people. Yeah,
forms of carpet pythons where people get crazy. I know that there has been some drama years ago with, you know, people driving each other out of the hobby because of Cypress Creek lines and shit. But like, but I don't know. I'll be able to tell more once I see him in the wild of what I got. I know, you know who has really good locality? Scott and Ty. Their stuff is legit.
Holy crap. Those guys? Yeah, no shit.
Who would figure?
You know what else they have? Perennies. Weird. It's
bastards.
Jerks. Beautiful How animals.
Dare you. I was trying to see if, let's see, 2022. Yeah, here we go. Let's see if I have a picture on the go of.
Yeah, I don't know. And that's the problem, is that I want to do it again, because it was like I told you, I re-upped the Savus because I was like, I will not be defeated. So
real quick, that's a picture of one of the diamonds in the cage doing the basking. That's reduced pattern. We're smaller and younger. But
I had to transport those things from all the way from New York to your house.
Killed you, didn't it?
It did. Each time it happened, I'm like, going to one place, you're like, good, you can. I'm like, you son of a bitch.
Stop. Damn it. I don't want to do this anymore.
I don't want to do it anymore. Give them up. Yeah.
Ah, shit. I was trying to find that picture.
You do. I paid for them.
That's just details.
Possession is 9/10 of the law.
Shit. And yeah, you know, Brandon, I think, has done several videos. I know he's been on podcasts talking about it. I think we had him on with him talking about it. Here he is.
Well, I know that Brandon's doing his are outside. There you are. And then I think Lucas's are outside. So it's like, in certain places, you can keep them outside. And
yeah, you can see well. Yeah, you can see along the wall here. That's their, I think,
setup.
The one that's open is diamonds. I think there's Imbricato on the other side.
God, that's awesome.
There you go. I was in heaven looking at that thing, man.
Yeah.
That's a real diamond.
That's a diamond. Yeah, that is a real diamond. Go back. That look on Scott's face right there where he's rubbing his head. Yeah. I assume you said something and he's like, no, just for the love of God, like, no.
Yeah.
Put it down. Like,
well, it looks like a diamond jungle. I don't know.
Yeah,
You're like, mate, how and dare you?
Smack you. Yeah.
There you go. That's a close
I love up. That. That's a great look.
Look at the yellow.
Yeah. That's my thing is I would kill someone for some white diamonds. So some really nice white diamonds.
Yeah.
But I will also settle. That's an Imbricata. Nobody cares about Imbricata.
Yeah. Oh, here's the other. There you go.
Oh.
There it is.
I love it.
That's better. I love how dark the black is, and then it's got the yellow and the highlights. That's a perenni.
The perenni. That's not a diamond. I think he eats diamonds. Yeah.
How cool is that?
Get the perenni out of here.
We'll stop that. Yeah, we're not
a monitor podcast. Like,
how dare you?
Yeah.
And then the last thing I was going to hit on is the reduced pattern diamond python morph
or Stardust.
So basically, so this sort of surfaced in the U.S. and the European collections, and it's a reduction in the background color and pattern The expression is more, some people say it's polygenic. Some people say it's recessive. Some people say they've done tests to where they've proved that it's not recessive. I think that nobody knows at this point what's going on. I tend to think it's recessive, but that's just, I don't know for sure. You know, I think Josh sort of is on the lines of he thinks that they are unsure of what the genetics is. However, I will say that they are found in the wild, because look at that.
Jesus H. Christ, I remember this now.
Yes.
So the question I have is that, so we've bred a reduced pattern to a normal, uh-huh, and we've gotten more reduced patterns out of the clutch, like babies reduced patterns, right? Stop. Yes. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Just stop showing. Stop it.
That thing is freaking cool, man.
Stop it. Because I'm like, I don't want to reduce patterns. And then it's like, no,
maybe I do.
Maybe I do. All right, maybe just one. Maybe one of the pair could be a reduced pattern.
Yeah, so these were found in the Blue Mountains, and there was a couple other ones found that were different than these ones that I'm sharing. Jeez. But basically, it's a reduced pattern. This one is more yellow, where I think our reduced patterns are more on the white side. But that's, I don't know, insane. It kind of reminds me of the Stonewash, don't it?
No, not at all. Where's the Stonewash?
Well, look, if you look at a Stonewash, it has the bald neck, it has the bald head, and then it has that thing that goes down the body.
But there's no ocelli.
Well, I'm not saying it's exactly like it. I'm just saying that.
You know what this reminds me of? A white-sided black rat snake. Well, not exactly, but
yeah, not 100% like 100%. It.
100%. I apologize. I didn't know we were doing in percentages.
Details.
Oh, I'll redo my answer. Yes, I believe you're correct.
Like, yeah. Look at that shot. Oh, man. Look at the tail, man. Stop. Look at that. That thing is gorgeous. God, holy shit, look at that head. Yeah, this thing is crazy.
I want a reduced pattern. I want the boy to be a reduced pattern.
That's what I have. I have a pair, but the male is the reduced, and the female is the one that possibly could breed this year. So we'll see what happens.
So if you get reduced patterns and you get normals, I'll be set, right?
Yeah, you'll be set.
Oh, my God.
I remember, dude, it was the MP days.
Yeah.
And I remember when Josh hatched out reduced patterns.
Right.
And Greg bought this animal, and it was in one of our first Morelia Python radio calendars.
Yes. Yep.
And it's actually it's my male reduced pattern diamond, because I ended up buying it from him later on. Oh, dude, that snake. When I saw that thing, I was like, similar to how you're having the experience now, looking at this wild one.
I remember a lot of the fights in the MP forums around reduced pattern and Stardust, or whatever the hell you want to call it, is people would be like, it only appears in this line. And then I think they got some out of a different line.
Yes.
And everybody was like, wow.
Well, every line has produced them yet now.
Right. So that's why I think there was different names for a little bit, because it's like, well, if it's a Stardust, it comes from this line. And if it's a reduced pattern, it comes from this line. And
yeah, you're probably right.
The same goddamn thing. Like, it's, yeah. God damn it.
So yeah, there's a reduced pattern. So if you want morphs, there's that too. But I think for me, I'm going to try to work on proving it out, you know, and see what I get.
Well, I mean, you can take the reduced to the normal and see what happens. And then you can also do reduced to reduce.
I can do reduced to reduce.
Yeah.
I can do a male normal.
Yeah.
Male normal to a reduced. And I can do a male reduced to a female normal.
Well, I mean, the one that's going to do it, if you get reduced patterns in any of the other clutches that is like reduced to a normal, then it possibly like that narrows it down. But the one that's going to kill it is if you do reduced to reduced and you get nothing but reduced. That's it, isn't it?
I think so. I think that happened, but I think there's still debate about it.
Travis?
That's why I don't understand.
Travis? I know you're listening, Travis.
Yes.
And I know you're like, well, technically, Owen is incorrect. I yes. will look. I look forward to no. the...
I'm usually the one that's incorrect.
Wednesday, Thursday text from Travis is what's going to yes. happen.
Yeah. Let's make sure. I yep. usually have maybe a good idea, but it's never right.
No.
It's always right.
I do love how he's like, listen, you guys did a good job. I'm like, oh, carrot. Here comes the stick. But, yep.
Yeah, here comes the big butt.
Here we go.
Oh, I love Travis. What a good guy.
Yeah. So, yeah, Travis will text us on Thursday and we'll have a better understanding of how these things could work. Yeah.
I don't know if he knows, but I would be curious to hear his thoughts on it. And then, as a parting gift for you, I'm going to show you a white diamond from Australia.
Thank you.
Black and white Thank diamond you. Because we don't really have them here in the States like this.
Oh, my God.
Stop See, it, the, man. The Stop problem it.
Is, the problem is that is gorgeous and I want it, but Darren has ruined me. Darren has just they're in my brain. I close my eyes. All I can see here is white light goes.
He can't escape it.
It's just like, that's gorgeous. But like, it's like, oh my God. Yep. It's that one white coastal that he had, that picture that he showed us with the inky kind of like it was black and it bled to blue around this one. I'm done.
Oh, yeah. It had the blue. Yeah. Oh my God.
I was done. So
that was
white
nuts.
Diamonds, absolutely gorgeous. I would love some white diamonds. White coastals. White coastals.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm really trying to work on that. But I guess I have to breed in order to.
I should probably help with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Just,
I know I can do it too. I know.
I haven't put it together. So.
Yeah.
But it was done with the jungles, so why couldn't it be done with coastals? But what a snake. Look at that contrast.
Oh, my God.
Come on, man. So this animal is basically, what would you say, a black base color with these white scales that are not covered completely. So they're like little white dots. And again, I'm going to post these pictures over to Discord, or you can... You know,
check them on the Patreon check out with the Patreon, video,
whatever. Yeah. Blah 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 blah. But
don't yell at us. Yeah.
Yep. Holy shit!
It's gorgeous.
Wow. Okay, we're gonna close it on that. Yeah. Diamond pythons are amazing.
Yeah.
Pretty straight ahead as far as their care. It's just different. It's not harder. It's not. It's different.
Yeah, it's not I have an open bin, so I'm going to throw a diamond python in there. It's like you have to think about it.
Yeah, there is one breeder. He hasn't officially bred them yet, but I think he's trying this year like me. But I just want to throw his name out there because he has a lot of cool diamonds and he knows a lot about them. Brian Hayes.
Yep, I saw his stuff.
He had the two in the tide thing sort of hanging out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so that's kind of diamond pythons. Hopefully we did a good job of understanding them. I feel like, there's probably more that we can pick apart and later on, and we'll do a follow-up when I breed them.
Yeah.
You know, when I have more experience of my own.
Yeah.
Let's see. Anything else you want to hit on diamond pythons?
No.
You just want them, right?
I do, yeah.
They're probably the most stable of the.
I will say that they
carpet complex.
Their price went to a certain point and then it hasn't moved since, which is fantastic.
Right. Supply and demand, probably, I would imagine.
Well, and also it's like one of those things where, you know, when the animal is set at a certain price and it kind of limits the people who will jump in on it, and then you have to take the time, and then, you know, it's not the race to the bottom. You know, I found out that there's a snake that I have that I charge this for and other people are charging way lower, but they also produce 10 times the amount that I do. And it's like, well, but every year you're producing that much. So you're selling these this cheap because you're in the next couple months, you're going to be buried in those baby animals again. And it's like, well, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would say that diamonds is pretty safe with that kind of stuff. And so are inlands.
Yep.
So
yep.
Kind of seems like if there's not a lot of morphs, it kind of stays.
Kind of stays nice. A little more stable.
Weird. Yeah. Weird that connection there.
So on our next episode of NPR, we're going to be talking about python eggs.
They're round. Ish.
They're round, yes.
Soft-ish.
Look like marshmallows.
A lot of ish, yeah.
But there was a guest that Nick and Lucas had on, the podcast that doesn't exist.
The one that we must never speak of, right.
Yeah. So since that's never going to be released.
They're not doing it.
I'm going to redo the show, and me, Owen, and Lucas are going to talk to the guest. I'm not going to say who. But we're going to talk to him about discussing python eggs. And Lucas said that when he had the discussion with him, there was a lot of things that he found very interesting about it. We've never done a show just discussing the eggs. So I think that
we're going to put out Nick's show. So help us, God. We have to do it ourselves. God damn it.
Yep. Maybe he'll get the idea. hint. I could put out a podcast. Can you
listen? You know, it all looks easy from the cheap seats. Okay,
sure it does. All right. So if you want to follow us, or you want to, so we also, for the Patreon people that are listening to this, we're going to be doing Carpets and Coffee because Patreon will get this tonight. We'll be doing Carpets and Coffee Monday, 6 o'clock biweekly. Yeah. So we'll tune in for that, and then like I said, we'll be back on schedule. And that kind of closes out our first quarter. And I think we fucking crushed it as far as shows this quarter.
I think last year when you were kind of like late, there weren't that many shows. I think I enjoyed last year better.
Owen's like, can we go back to 2023?
What do I got to do at your job to make that the thing again?
Like, yeah. Oh, man. What a terrible year. But here we are. So let's see. We got Cold Blooded Caffeine. You can check out. Oh no, let me back up. If you want to support the show, here's some ways you can. So you can follow us at. If you want to support just directly Morelia Python Radio, we're on Instagram as Morelia Python Radio. If you want to support the network and all the stuff that's on it, we're also NPR Network. And we're that on Facebook as well. You can subscribe and share the podcast. That always helps us out. And just check out the other podcasts that are on the network. Maybe you're into different species. Owen just did a show with the Colubrid and Colubroid guys, episode 50. How cute.
It was adorable.
Did you tell them that?
I didn't want to rain on their parade, but they're also having they're making announcements about their Colubrid Fest. And I'm like, oh, you sons of bitches. Like, it was like,
yeah.
But their Colubrid Fest is going to be, more akin to an ICAST.
Yes.
So
this is kind of like where I wanted to take Carpet Fest, but
yeah, but
you got to collude with people. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. We'll just stick to the old, beef and beer type of situation.
They were simple folk.
Yes.
It was cool. It was cool hanging out with them. And then it's hilarious because they're like, well, you know, you got all this luck with the Madagascar hognose. I'm like, yeah, you know, if eggs show up this year, I'll have 4 years running. I go downstairs after the show and they're goddamn eggs. I'm like, God damn
it. Like, I saw that.
Congrats, okay. Man. Like, yeah. So, yep.
So now you have it dialed in. You know what I mean? 4 years in a row.
Dialed in.
You got it dialed in. Yeah.
Dialed in. Yeah.
So now what do you do with that project? Do you move it on? Do you keep it? Is that still to be determined?
I think that is to be determined, but I think I'm leaning more towards cutting back to a trio because I have six. Oops, and six is a lot. And
you
I would
have
like
three and three diamond pythons.
Exactly. Plus, you know, I producing 21 of them a year because they all lay like 7 to 8 babies. I haven't had a problem moving them on and selling them and stuff like that. Right. But I also don't want to go nuts. But I'm not sure how many are being imported from Madagascar. So I'm not sure if I really want to totally cut and run, or also if I go down to a trio, I would want to go down to a trio and maybe mix up the trio so I could have unrelated animals together so that I'm producing the best kind of babies. But then the issue then comes if I start messing with stuff, start pulling wires, and am I breaking the machine? Like, it's there's a lot. I think that's a to be determined. This year, though, there's going to be a lot of cage moving around because the Kribo are leaving, the False Water Cobras are moving, and then the Mad Hogs are moving into bigger cages, so the trios will be maybe a little bit set up better. But, yeah, it does eventually go down to the point of, do I need this many of them? The next one on that block is I have 2.2 adult rhino rat snakes, and then I have a trio of juvies that are coming up. And it's like, that's a lot of rhinos. It's a lot of rhinos.
You got a lot of decisions to make, man.
It's nuts. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, so you can check us out on YouTube. All the podcasts get uploaded there. NPR Network. We do have Cold-Blooded Creations episode coming out. There's a Boa 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 on deck. There's Carpet Cliff Notes is coming up soon-ish, I think. Trying to think what else is on tap.
Yeah.
I think that's it for now. Forgetting stuff, but it's all good. But you should check out Owen on Klubert and Klubert Radio. Those guys are awesome. They're doing a great job. Yeah, so Cold-Blooded Caffeine. They what?
It was a fun time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. They're good guys. Cold-Blooded Caffeine. We have an affiliate code. They have amazing coffee. The best thing is 5% of their proceeds from every bag is donated to wildlife conservation in coffee producing countries. So Trey and McKendrick, great guys. Make sure you go give them some support. And if you follow our affiliate link, we get a little kickback. Yep. And then we got Cold-Blooded Cafe. Go ahead, Owen.
Cold-Blooded Cafe. You can use the code NPR10 to get 10% off of your first purchase. If you have used the code before, you can now use it again one more time. So if you've used it and then you've bought other rodents from them, you can use the code again. They have reset the code, but it is, again, still one time only. So they're giving you another bite of the apple. They have many other kinds of deals and sales that they do, and the NPR10 can be added to a sale or deal that they are running. I would definitely follow them on all their social media because they do announce when they have sales of different size of rodents, and they also request what should they put on sale, what should they add, what should they take away. And they will also do discounts for if you set up standing orders, if they end up doing like a different kind of stuff like that. And they are they're supposedly adding quail at some point soon. Eric and I put in our orders this weekend and probably getting them some point this week. So we'll see how that goes. I mean, it is Sunday, so I don't know what the hell's going on.
You got to let me know what I owe you too. But I love them. I've used them forever, for a long time, years, probably close to five, six years I've been using them. So
my freezer's full and the snakes dwindle it and then it just gets refilled. Like it's a constant cycle. Yeah. So
good quality stuff. So if you want to learn more about Morelia, you can check out our website, MoreliaPythonRadio.com. If you want to get in touch with us, you can send us an email at MoreliaPythonRadio@gmail.com. Don't forget about our Discord that we talked about. So if you're interested in joining that, you can send us a link. I think as we get more people over there, that will be our go-to spot, at least for me. have the people that are awesome in the community, because that is the one good thing about the Morelia community is a lot of awesome people. And then we have last two things to hit on is our Teespring store. And then we also have our Patreon. Like I said, for our Patreon, we do there's a couple different tiers and stuff in there, but we put out a newsletter once a month. That's going to be coming at the beginning of April. I also started just writing like blogs and stuff of certain things. I have like the Morelia Python Radio story that I'm going to upload to there. That would be over on the Patreon, so people can check that out and read it. There's a little chat over there that we share stuff on, and I try to share like various pictures of stuff that I have and put up articles and all that kind of stuff. So
cool.
If you're into carpets or Morelia, it's kind of a cool little community that we have. We've done it so far. I know last year was terrible with us with the Patreon and all that stuff, but this year, the Eric and Owen shows, we typically are doing those on Patreon, so you can check them out there too.
Yeah.
That's it, right?
Anything else? I would say that the next show I'm doing is the April 13th Morgantown or Hamburg show. So come check it out there. But other than that, thanks everybody for listening. We'll catch everybody back here next week for some more Morelia Python Radio. Good night.